Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Porter Harlem Talk Radio, and I'm your host for this show and also publisher of Port of Harlem Magazine at portofharlem.net. If you are listening via the internet, you can type your questions in the comment box. You can also call and listen by dialing on your phone at 516-531-9540. And if you want to ask a question after you are connected, press 1 and please be in a quiet place. You can also visit portofharlem.net and click Port of Harlem Talk Radio from the menu to hear this and past episodes. We're also available on about 7 podcast platforms. And lastly, We Talk Production sponsors Port of Harlem Talk Radio. Our guest today is Dr. Okeji Anyanwu. He is professor of history and director of African and African-American studies at Eastern Kentucky University in Richmond, Kentucky. He just released, quote, The Making of Mbano, British Colonialism, Resistance, and Diplomatic Engagements in Southeastern Nigeria between 1906 and 1960. Just to give you a little bit of background information, Mbano is a community located in the southeastern state of Imo State, Nigeria. The community spans 2 local government areas with about 400,000 people, or for our American audience, it's about the size of the city of Oklahoma City. In his book, Anyanwu repudiates the misrepresentation of the continent by providing authentic, ironclad proof that Africans, in this case, the Igbos of Mbano in southeastern Nigeria, were resilient and unyielding to colonial mandates. So, welcome, Dr. Anyanwu.
Thank you so much.
Okay, I'm looking forward to learning more about how a subgroup of Africans resisted the European invasion. So I think we have established that Mbano is a community mostly made up of Igbos in Nigeria. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And I believe this is your hometown.
Yes, I was born in Mbano. And I've always wanted to write a book about Mbano, so I'm very excited that I've been able to publish the most authoritative source on the colonial history of Mbano, a town where I was born.
Well, you know, I like you already because I often get a chance to write about my hometown, Gary, and whenever I have the opportunity, I definitely do it.
And I want to thank Eastern Kentucky University for providing me with the funds to travel extensively. I went to the National Archives in London twice. I went to Nigeria more than 8 times. And then Indiana University Archives at Bloomington to collect data for this book project. So I thank Eastern Kentucky University for making it possible.
Well, before we go too far on that, let's talk about the research then. Mm-hmm. You know, it's always interesting. You said you went to London to find out more about what happened in your hometown in Nigeria. Explain how that happens, that an African or anyone in that particular will go to London to look for information about their hometown and to Indiana University in Indiana. What happened?
If you go to the National Archives in London, it contains a lot of sources on colonial policies in Africa. So, and the book I'm writing, I'm looking at both the colonial sources and also nationalist sources, African sources, to be able to draw my conclusions. I didn't want to rely only on letters or petitions written by ordinary people in Mbano against colonial administrators. I didn't want to rely on newspapers produced by nationalists fighting for or resisting white supremacy. So I had to also obtain minutes of meetings or diaries, you know, kept by colonial officials who worked in Mbano from 1906 to 1960 to begin to have a sense of what they thought about the people, how they responded to them. Because getting sources from both sides will help me to come to a better understanding or paint a better picture of how life was for the people during the colonial period. So those colonial documents are found in the National Archives in London and then Bloomington, National Archives in Bloomington.
In Bloomington, Indiana.
Indiana, yes.
And how did those documents get into the Great Midwest?
How did the documents get into the Indiana Archives in Bloomington?
Yeah, what made them get there? Did Indiana buy them? Is there a special library there on African studies or what?
Yes, they have a special collection on African studies. And the archive is very reputable for, very well known for collecting sources on African colonial history. So I was fortunate to go there and spend a couple of weeks in downloading all those sources, especially colonial reports in the early part of the colonial period, 1906, 07, 08, and 010. That was most of the sources I got from there, especially that was during the period of resistance, violent resistance of the people against British encroachment into their communities. Although eventually the resistance moved to something else, more complex engagement with colonial structures.
Okay, I find it is very intriguing that even the documents are held in Indiana. You know, lots of times when people speak of resisting white supremacy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, there's always the discussion how, say, the Europeans, in this case the Americans too, have a hold on many of the artifacts. But let's start with chapter one of your book. And the title is called British Conquest and Consolidation of Colonial Rule in Mbano, 1906 and 1915. Can you summarize that chapter one, with the information you share in that chapter, but share it to our audience? And just give us a snippet.
Okay. Now, that chapter, there's always the assumption made by Eurocentric authors that once an African society was militarily conquered, they automatically submitted to colonial rule. And this article deconstructs that assumption by showing that even though Mbano people were militarily conquered in 1906, it was difficult for the British to maintain effective colonial control even after conquering the people. Even though the people had surrendered, they continued to resist colonial domination. In fact, one of the ways of establishing control by the British was to establish native courts. And those native courts were avenues that the colonial powers used to establish control. And the people rejected the native courts and insisted that they would not submit to those courts. So from 1906, when Mbano was conquered, until about 1908, 1909, the court officials sent to different towns to execute warrants were either attacked, some of them were killed, some towns like Omonakano refused to have any relationship with the government. In fact, the colonial official put it this way, that the Omonakano people in Mbano refused to have any intercourse with the government. And so that resistance, it was difficult for colonial officials to effectively control the people. And one of the things I argued in the chapter is that the Obunuri Oracle, which was the local deity in that area, provided the stimulant for the early anti-colonial resistance. Because that was their religion. That was their, they had the religious beliefs revolved around the Obunuri Oracle, which was very popular in the area. And people always go to the oracle to resolve their cases. The oracle served as the judicial, you know. So for the British to establish native courts threatened the control the oracle had on the people over the centuries. And they resisted. And the British now decided to embark on what they call pacification, which was essentially sending military police patrols, military escorts to go and subdue villages that were still resisting colonial domination. And that continued till 1915, when the First World War began. And there was a lot of rumor in Mbano that the British colonial administrators were about to leave the area. They were losing the war against the Germans. And remember, Nigeria has a neighboring country that was controlled by the Germans. And during the First World War, British troops were being, you know, redeployed to fight the Germans in Cameroon. So the people interpreted that to mean that the British power was waning, and then that made them to intensify their anti-colonial resistance. So the early anti-colonial resistance against white supremacy, as reflected in Chapter 1, was inspired by the Obunuri Oracle that reflected the people's traditional values and traditional beliefs and traditional religion. And they posed a very powerful threat to British attempt consolidate power. They had to send a lot of military expeditions or escorts to suppress villages. In fact, some of the things the villages did then was, once they realized that the British escorts were coming to attack their villages, they always escaped to the bush. In the case of Umunakano and many others, they escaped to the bush from where they shot at the colonial officials, killing so many of them.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the British decided to use scorched earth policy by burning down, you know, homes, destroying farmlands, destroying livestock.
What did they do about, because you mentioned a couple of times about the traditional religion or the oracle that the people had, and that gave them strength to resist. I guess eventually the British began to attack their belief system as well.
That is a very, very important question, because all the British official documents that are found in London always talked about one oracle, one Obunuri Oracle that has been at the center, or in fact, the phrase they used was, this oracle was at the bottom of all the troubles that we are experiencing here. So the British, it was said at the bottom of all the trouble. So the district commissioner in Owerri decided to send military patrols to go and locate the oracle and destroy the oracle once and for all, to capture the priests of the oracle and send them on exile or execute them or send them to prison. And that was what they did in the spring of 1908. They spent hours looking for the location of the oracle, asking people questions. In fact, the British soldiers who went to locate the oracles had this rumor that the oracles had crocodiles, reptiles, with gold trinkets in them. So they were also inspired by, you know, becoming very rich, because the assumption was that if we can locate the oracle and kill the reptiles, kill the crocodiles, we will be able to become very rich. and get all the gold from the crocodiles. And they did. They ultimately found the oracle, the site of the oracle in 1908. And to their surprise, there was no gold. There was no gold, no silver, no copper. All they found was the priest of the oracle and also crocodiles moving around. So they shot all the crocodiles, burned down the entire location, captured the priest and sent them to Onitsha where they were tried and put in prison. And that actually undermined the people's will to resist because
right,
of the force with which...
Let me get this straight too. So you're saying that they told the people who were hunting for the oracles that the alligators had gold as a way to encourage them to hunt for these animals?
Yeah, Adam, there's what the British military leader of the patrol, his name is Adam. I got his diaries from Rhodes Library in London where he detailed his movement. And he said that there was this belief among the soldiers. How that belief came into being, he did not know. But there was this widespread belief that there was gold trinkets. And once we get there, we will become rich.
Got you.
So at the end of his diary, he said, I was so disappointed that we found nothing.
I hear you. But, you know, Dr. Anyanwu, the reason I find this to be fascinating is because these stories are replicated around the world. Even here in the United
mm-hmm.
States, when we talk about Nat Turner or we talk about in West Papua out in Oceania, the stories are replicated.
Yes.
But number two, but I want to get to chapter two, too, so we get to a little bit more parts of your book because just what you read, what you told me about chapter one makes me want to read the book. But in
mm-hmm.
chapter two, you had a very loaded title. And that title is, I had to put my hands between their legs. And the other part is Mbono Women and Anti-Colonial Rebellion, 1929 to 1930. But first, can you
mm-hmm.
explain, what does it mean, I had to put my hand between their legs, please? What does that mean?
Yeah, this was a statement made by a man called Okoriorio, who was the warrant chief of Nzerem. And this was made in 1929 during the women-led anti-colonial rebellion. In the early 1929, during the onset of the Great Depression, there was a lot of economic crisis in European colonies in Africa, including in Europe. And the colonial officials increased taxes on the people, on men, and there was rumor that the British would increase taxes on women. And also, this was a time when the prices of palm oil or palm produce, palm oil, palm kernel, which was the major export earner for the people, was going down. The prices were declining so fast, whereas the prices of imported goods from Europe was rising. And this was a time when the warrant chiefs had dictatorial power. They had the power to send anybody to prison, because these are local warrant chiefs. These are Africans. These are Mbano people appointed by the British to be in charge of the native courts. They used their powers in manners that shocked the sensibilities of many African people. And women dominated the market. They were in charge of producing palm oil, palm kernel, selling. So the Great Depression affected their livelihoods. Coupled with the corruption of the native courts, the insensitivity of the British colonial policies. So by 1929, women gathered, protested at different markets, stopped people from selling at the market. And then Okoriorio, one of the native court officials, came, and the woman told him that he had put his hands between their legs, which means He has invaded their private spaces. He has violated their tradition. So this
a European man or an African man? I got lost on that part. Was the European man or an African man accused of putting his hand in their private parts?
Yeah, they accused the African chief, Okoriori, who was a representative of the colonial powers.
Gotcha.
Remember, Africans, the British had indirect rule system of administration, whereby when they conquer an area, all they did was to appoint one of the chiefs and empower the person to collect taxes, and then they empowered the individual against the wishes of majority of the people. So when the women were protesting, they were targeting those representatives of the colonial powers. Even though they were Africans, they were serving the interest of the colonial power, not the interest of the people. So when the disturbance began, Okoriori went in there to ask the women to disperse, ask the women to be careful. And the woman said, no, he has put his hands between their legs. Why? Because he sent one of their relatives to prison because he was unable to pay fine over a crime that was not considered a crime in pre-colonial Africa. So this chapter looked at women-led anti-colonial rebellion, how women championed the early violent resistance against colonialism. Even though by 1915, it seemed as though the people had submitted to colonial powers, but that submission did not endure because by 1929, owing to the Great Depression, once the British began to consolidate power and the people began to realize that the civilizing mission was a mistaken mission or was unrealized, the idea of paternalism that the British projected was not there. They could not see it. So women were the ones that led that rebellion by burning down houses of native court rulers, burning down native courts, closing down courts. And in fact, women destabilized colonial administration from 1929 until 1930s.
That is intriguing. And so this is all before, we would say, modern Western feminism even took root in the Western world.
Exactly. Exactly. And what I find fascinating was that at the end of that rebellion, the British suppressed the rebellion, and then they set up a commission to review what happened and then recommend punishment for those women who played a part in the rebellion. And those women attended the commission. I saw the report of the commission in London. It's about 50, it should be about 100-page report. And that report contained testimonies by women who testified that they were even violated by native court officials when they went to their houses to protest. Many of them accused them of rape. Many of them accused them of sexual assault. And they were expecting that the British colonial government will put those people on trial. But that never happened. All the British did was to impose punishment on the towns or the cities or the villages that played more active role by levying them. Initially, the levy was about £1, but it was increased to £2, you know, in what the British call collective punishment for
gotcha.
Those who played a part in destroying or challenging colonial rule.
Before we get to chapter six, and we have about 5 more minutes left, I should correct myself. Actually, women got the right to vote in the United States in 1920. So the suffragist movement, especially for white women, had already taken root and was blossoming. Mm-hmm. But we see that back in the homeland, at least in Nigeria in particular, women were also taking their rightful place. But in chapter six in your book is called Deities, the Holy Rollers and Indigenous Religious Identities during the Nigerian Civil War, 1967 to 1970. what is that chapter pretty much about?
Was it 1967 or 1970? Did I put that in it?
I think it's chapter six. It's called Deities, the Holo Rollers, and Indigenous Rituals. You know what? I added too much of that. So let me say it's just chapter six. And chapter six is called Deities, the Holy Rollers, and Indigenous Religious Identities.
Chapter six, I try to look at the impact of Christianity on the people. Christianity was a vehicle of introducing European values or Christian values on the people. So the statement made by one of the chiefs called Onwumano of Abo in Ugiri, this chief was a Christian. He converted to Christianity. But at the same time, he was the traditional ruler of the area who was supposed to uphold the traditional values of the people. And he was asked this question, which is, what happens if these two civilizations clash? If there's a clash of two civilizations, Christian civilization and indigenous African religious civilization, what would you do? And he said, if necessity should arise, I will follow the custom of my father first. So the argument I made in this chapter is that in spite of the Christianizing influence, or in spite of the influence or westernizing influence of Christianity, the people remained faithful to their religious values. But the introduction of Christianity created new communities within existing communities. And those new communities caused a lot of conflict. But at the end of the day, a majority of the people remained faithful to their religious beliefs. In other words, Christianity did not undermine the vitality and the continuation of indigenous African religions during the colonial period.
So I guess in many ways they intertwine the two.
Yeah, in many ways. In other words, when they found it convenient to embrace Christianity, of course, most of them who obtained Western education had no choice but to become Christians, because missionaries were the ones that dominated or provided education, Western education. So if you are coming to school to obtain education, without which your social mobility will be stunted, then you have no choice but to become a Christian. But even while they became Christians, their faithfulness to their indigenous African religion remained undiminished throughout the colonial period. In fact, one of the examples I gave in this book was, you know, there was a man who became a Christian and died, and his relatives who attended the church with him, you know, wanted him to be buried the traditional way. But the pastor of the church insisted on burying him in the church and giving him a Christian burial. In the night, his people went and exhumed his body and took his body to the village where he was given proper burial. Even though the pastor protested, but the British district officer supported what the villagers did. but at the same time, he cautioned the people not to take laws into their hands, while at the same time acknowledging their cultural values. Because he did not want to create any conflict in the society.
Okay, let's wrap this story up. And I got your point, and I appreciate it greatly. And I really like the idea of this book. I want to read this book because it adds to the narrative that happens pretty much with African people around the world. Same process, same pattern, different place. But it helps, like you said, repudiates that Africans didn't just lay down and turn over and say, okay, I'm done. They resisted. So you want to give them
so
the 30
essentially,
seconds? You want to give them the 30
what
seconds?
I did in, that is second, what I did in this book. Mm-hmm. Okay, let me give you a 30-second summary.
Wrap up. Go ahead.
Okay. So what I try to do in this book is to introduce readers to a wide variety of people in colonial Mbano, women, children, farmers, traders, who contributed to the history or the historical experience of southeastern Nigeria and whose names hardly appear in history books. So the argument I made in this book is that Mbano people successfully invoked their pre-colonial social, cultural, political, and economic values in confronting the British colonial government and living a society, a post-colonial society, that, in my view, worthy of their sacrifices.
Well, I want to thank you very much for your time. We look forward to our readers listening to this story and also getting a snippet of your book in the next issue of Port of Harlem. Thanks for listening, and thanks for liking us on Facebook, and visit us at portofharlem.net. Thank you so much, Dr. Anyue and Anyuwu, and have a good evening.
You too. Thank you so much for having me.
Take care.